So we are continuing in chapter 8 of Schaeffer's How Should We Then Live? And so last week we talked about, so this chapter 8 is on the breakdown on philosophy and science. Last week we talked about the breakdown of science from the early rising of modern science with a very theistic, Christian theistic worldview as being the basis. Having that absolute that drives order in all things. So it was very much driven on that. Well, chapter 8 talks about the breakdown of that. So last week we talked about the breakdown of science, and now this week we're talking about the breakdown of philosophy, where we're seeing that. Not that we haven't already seen that when you consider even what Plato and Aristotle and, of course, the Renaissance era dealt in terms of philosophy, but there is a shift, a big shift that starts to happen in this period that we're going to be talking about this morning from even these the older philosophic views by the non-Christian philosophers. These older philosophic views that were really optimistic. They were still optimistic because they assumed in those views that people would be able, through reason alone, establish a unified and true knowledge of what reality is. And, you know, that when this happens, when people would be able to do that, then they would have satisfying explanations for everything that we would encounter as a human race in the universe, for all that we do and all that we think. They were optimistic that we would get to it eventually. A lot of what I'm going to cover this morning is going to sound repetitive to what we mentioned last week, because it's that underlying thought that not only impacted philosophy, but of course science. And later on, through the study, when we talked how it impacts even theology. Well, on through the centuries, each one of these non-Christian, older philosophers, each one showed that the previous philosopher had failed. Each one that would come along, the newfound idea, that would show that the older one had failed when they tried to construct an answer to get to the universal from the particulars. And so each one would show that the older one failed, where the future thinkers would again show that what was taught was inadequate in terms of trying to contain all of knowledge and all of life. So they would try to refine that as time goes by throughout the centuries. The older philosophers did not find the answer. But again, they optimistically believed that somebody eventually would. And then there was a drastic shift that came. And it is this shift that causes really modern man to be what we understand modern man to be these days from a secular perspective. Well, many, many scholars regard René Descartes as the father of modern philosophy. He died in 1650 as the father of modern philosophy. And so a lot of what I'm going to be talking about, some key men, but a lot of their thoughts were derived from Descartes and what he taught. Well, there were four men that directed primarily this shift from the older optimistic view to the more modern outlook in which eventually optimism is lost. Optimistic hope is lost. And the shift came because really this humanistic ideal had failed. As Schaeffer explains in his book, people had gone round and round variations of really the same answers over the centuries. He describes going around a large dark room, a circular dark room, looking for a way out. And it was slowly dawning on them that there really is no exit. There is no way out of understanding beyond the particulars. Well, that realization came in more or less the 18th century, And with it, the stance of humanistic man changed from optimism to pessimism. He gave up a hope for a unified answer. The old optimism of a unified and true knowledge on the basis of reason alone, which was so much a part of the High Renaissance, on you could do that on reason alone, that hope was gone. And it had an enormous effect on Western culture, in society, down to any average man out in society. Well, the four main people that I'm going to talk about this morning that were part of that dramatic shift were Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Immanuel Kant, Georges Wilhelm Hegel, and Søren Kierkegaard. So Rousseau, Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard. And I think to many of you, these names are going to sound familiar. Well, the first, and you could argue the chiefest, at least Schaeffer does, of these four men was Rousseau. He died in 1778, just to give you a time frame. He was a French-speaking Swiss from Geneva. And you'll remember that the humanism of the High Renaissance ran into problems because with man beginning only from himself, there is tension between the individual things, these particulars, and any meaning for these particulars. And so you could think of it as depicted on that first square in the handout. If you haven't got a handout, Henry, I think, do you have more? In that first square where it talks about the universals, which really give meaning to these individual things, these particulars, being over the particulars, you know, which would be everything from the smallest atom to you and me. Again, we've went over this many times, all the individual things throughout that you can see. Well, by the time of Rousseau, the humanistic problem had developed even further. With Rousseau, the same problem was worded differently. It's the same thing. That's why in the title I have on the slide, Humanistic Formula to the Fourth Power. They're just rehashing the same thing. They keep trying to improve upon the other ones. And now the other one, he didn't quite get there. So let me give you my formula. Well, by the time of Rousseau, it was being worded differently, and it was expressed like you see this autonomous freedom over autonomous nature. There were two parts to this new formulation of the old humanist problem. So first, there were those who were aware that in the area of reason, people were increasingly coming to the place where everything was seen as a machine, even people. And I talked about that last week. At the end of his life, Leonardo da Vinci, he had begun to foresee that beginning humanistically with mathematics, which he tried to prove a lot of things through mathematics, that beginning humanistically with mathematics, someone really only has particulars, those individual things that you're trying to explain in mathematics. And you're never really going to come to a universal meaning. He had hoped in his earlier studies that he would get there. But he realized in the end, all you're going to have is mechanics. No true value or meaning. Explain. It took humanistic thought 250 years to arrive at a place that Leonardo had foreseen. But by the 18th century, you could argue that it had definitely arrived, the understanding of the problem, really where everything is the machine, including people. Well, secondly, Rousseau himself, he viewed the tension being specifically at the point of society, of political life, and the culture. He would see the tension in the particulars on that level, society, political life, and the culture. And he viewed primitive man, and he you get the idea of the noble savage from his teachings. He viewed primitive man as being superior to civilized man. Rousseau did. He once wrote, quote, "If man is good by nature, as I believe to have shown him to be, it follows that he stays like that as long as nothing foreign to him corrupts him." The noble savage. Well, clearly in strong contrast, Scripture teaches that as a result of the fall, man is by nature sinful and rebels against God. Well, in 1749, when Rousseau, he concluded that the Enlightenment, with its emphasis on reason, coming to an answer by reason and through the arts and sciences, that the Enlightenment had really caused people to lose more than they had gained by putting their hopes on reason. So he really personally had given up faith in any progress. I guess you could say in some ways, you wouldn't argue that he was like Da Vinci. And at the end, you'll hopefully be able to understand why. But he certainly had given up on reason as being able to give up any hope to come with a unification between what he determined as autonomous freedom and autonomous man, which is, again, a rehashing of the universal over the particulars. His followers, Rousseau and his followers, they began to play down reason eventually, to play it down. And they saw the restraints of civilization as evils that you want to free yourself from, thinking, you know, man was born free, but everywhere he is in chains. Rousseau, he said that. And he saw the primitive as being innocent and the autonomous freedom as the final good. You want to get from autonomous nature, where man is, to autonomous freedom. We must understand that the freedom, however, that Rousseau advocated was not just freedom from God or freedom from the Bible, but freedom from any kind of restraint, freedom from culture, freedom from any authority, an absolute freedom of the individual, a freedom in which the individual is the center of the universe. I guess you could say he's espousing the philosophy of a 2-year-old as a grown man. Good coffee. All right. Well, theoretically, this individual freedom would be perfectly reflected in what he would call the general will, the will of the general population, of the secular movement. What's the will of the general will of the people? And he reflected it in the social contract, which is the title of a paper that he wrote at one time. I'll get to that in a minute. It was a utopian concept that he had, and you could see it being played out, and the results of it by the French Revolution, and its reign of terror, where what you found was a desire to see a purification of the general will, a purification of it, of the general or the popular will. And that purification meant not only the loss of freedom for the individual, but a gain of freedom for the general population. And it also meant, eventually, when you're looking at the French Revolution, the guillotine. So you see this statism view and understanding come out of a lot of Rousseau's teachings and thoughts. Rousseau's concept of autonomous freedom, it clashed with his own thoughts when he moved from the individual to the society. Again, he tried to break things down into these views of society, political views, culture. He wrote The Social Contract, and he wrote it in 1762. And in that book, he wrote, quote, "In order in order that the social compact, may not be an empty formula, it tacitly includes the undertaking, which alone can give force to the rest, that whoever refuses to obey the general will shall be compelled to do so by the whole body. This means nothing less than he will be forced to be free, end quote. Basically meaning that one must strongly consider how the social contract that he's writing about, you have to consider how it's executed. The way he put it, as it tacitly includes the undertaking. How do you execute this social? How do you bring it about to fruition? How is the social contract, how is it executed? Not just focusing on the ideals. And executing the social contract includes how to force the general or popular will on everyone. Now, does that not sound familiar even in our day? One more humanistic utopianism. Once a more humanistic utopianism ends, once it ends in tyranny, whether, you know, you could see that as an outplay of what happened in the French Revolution. The guy who was the leader, Robespierre, he was a follower of Rousseau's teachings, even though it's argued that he claimed to be a professed Christian. In reality, he truly was a follower of Rousseau and his teachings, and he rationalized his actions on the teachings of Rousseau, which were so popular at that time. Well, certainly Rousseau's concept of freedom, it showed itself in many forms the way he wrote it about it. He tried to explain it in different ways. For example, he wrote in his book called The Confessions, published in 1782. He argued that as a means of true freedom, the best education is virtually the absence of education. The best education is virtually the absence of education. This had an impact on later education theories of self-expression, which we can see today, still being influential in a lot of what we see in the realm of education. He had a profound effect on the thoughts and the lives of many who followed him. Even today, his thinking influenced many of what's even being taught today. So that's why he's really, of those four men, the chiefest of them, Rousseau. Well, his concept of autonomous freedom led to what Schaeffer called was the Bohemian ideal. So in our own recent past, Schaeffer talks about this, that this Bohemian ideal, it was a factor leading expressly to what we saw in the 60s with the hippies, this Bohemian ideal, where the Western world experienced really what was a paradigm shift in shared values. In the 60s, we saw a paradigm shift in shared values. Typically, what you would see is generation after generation spawning after their parents, and they may have a little twist here and there of what was coming, but in the 60s, you saw a paradigm shift. And Rousseau's and his teachings had a big impact on it. Rousseau didn't stand alone in his thoughts. In Great Britain, David Hume, maybe you've heard of David Hume, a Scottish philosopher. He died in 1776. He was working at exactly the same time that Rousseau was working. Hume, he also criticized reason as a method of knowing truth, and Hume defended the centrality of human experience and human feeling. You know, what can we build upon the human experience and human feeling to understand autonomous freedom? How do we get to the universal from that perspective? Well, in his criticism of reason as a method of knowing, He questioned the existence of cause and effect, of the concept of cause and effect. I don't know how people could fall into this and accept it, but he challenged it. He had a wide influence on British philosophy and on the next guy that we're going to be talking about, Immanuel Kant in Germany. Along the same lines, also a movement that was influenced by Rousseau, you have Romanticism. It was born, it's believed to have been born in Germany with the likes of Goethe, Schiller, and Lessing, men who died in the late 18th century, early 19th century. Now, all of these were men, at first, they were followers of the Enlightenment, before they turned to be followers of Rousseau. And reason was their hero. It was the hero of the Enlightenment. But eventually, men like Goethe and Schiller, based on Rousseau's teachings, emotion became the hero. Emotion became the hero of Romanticism. Schiller, he wrote, "All creatures drink in joy from nature's breast." And Schaeffer says that pretty much sums up the ideals of Romanticism. It's all about the emotion and the feeling. Give up on reason. Romanticism, it was the philosophical and also literary movement of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and it emphasized spontaneous feeling and individual freedom, and again, in reaction to the rationalism of the Enlightenment. About the feeling, okay? Emotionalism. Romanticism, so you can see how that keep those thoughts together. Beethoven died in 1827. He kind of fell in this stream of teaching of Romanticism. He carried its expression into his music. Schaeffer, he argues that Beethoven's music, more than that of any composer before him, gives the impression of being a direct outpouring of his personality. And I like Beethoven. I love his sonatas. And you can really sense a strong feeling being invoked in there. But you could argue that in much of classical music. But Schaeffer believes that it's his music, especially toward the end of his composing period, that he opened the door to what we have in terms of our 20th century music. Again, a romanticist. William Wordsworth, English poet, romanticist. Samuel Taylor Coleridge. They were in the same stream as well. Wordsworth, he found his values in man's instincts rather than in learning. In man's instincts rather than learning. Again, you have this ideal of noble savage. Wordsworth believed in the elevation of nature as something which is our greater teacher. So this idea of nature, it does echo Rousseau's concept of this idea of a noble savage, where what is natural is morally good. What is natural is morally good. So I'm hoping that as you're hearing these things come along, and I think that's a lot of what Schaeffer's trying to do is teach us, is recognizing what you hear today in our society, these ideas being explained as we look at history in this review of, okay, so that starts to explain why some of the things that we hear being taught and the philosophy that's being taught, what an atheist would argue, trying to elevate nature as something as our greater teacher, and that it's what is natural is morally good. Because, you know, they had no absolute to draw on a moral concept. It's really hypocritical of them in their thought. Well, the attempt to make nature the basis of morals was also taken into the area of civil law. Where it was called the natural law school of jurisprudence. Let me say that again. the natural law school of jurisprudence. Its influence is still felt today in the areas of those who practice law. It was an attempt in this 18th century period to have principles of law that could exist even if there is no God. You can still have principles of law without God. And that's what it tried to espouse and teach. The students of law from this perspective thought that a complete and perfect system of law could be constructed based on the principles that you would see in natural law. There's a problem, a serious problem that Schaeffer points out in this, in trying to construct a system of law upon nature. He says nature is cruel as well as non-cruel. Cruel as well as non-cruel. What does that mean, non-cruel? Well, I'll touch on it a little bit more later, but you definitely see the cruelty in nature. You can see it in, you know, beast killing beast, volcanoes wiping out societies or towns. But, you know, you don't have cruel versus good. How do you have a, what do you even know what is good? What force is there to, benevolent force out there to push out good? Nature is either cruel or it's non-cruel. It's not benevolent. So it's viewed that way, that nature is cruel as well as non-cruel. If you consider the dilemma that faced Rousseau, you can see that also in a famous painter, Gauguin. Now, Gauguin lived a bit later. He died in the early 20th century. He was a French painter, and he was on the hunt for total freedom. And in that hunt, he deserted his family. He thought that would be a good idea to desert my family, and he went to Tahiti, where he tried to find the answer in the noble savage. Well, after he lived in Tahiti for a while, he found that the ideal of the noble savage was an illusion. In his last great painting, which is entitled, now, it's a long title, Whence Come We? What Are We? Whither Do We Go? That was the title of his last great painting. In that painting, he showed that man in himself has no answer to the ultimate questions. This is what he discovered trying to live with the noble savage. And that answer, that man has no answer, also applies as much to the primitive man as it does to the civilized man. And he painted that title directly on the painting so no one can miss the meaning. He wrote about this painting as he worked on it. And while he, in his writings, he called that art, that picture, a philosophical work. A philosophical work that is comparable to the gospel. That's what he wrote. But as Schaeffer explains, what a gospel. Because in that picture is a picture of a primitive old woman dying. It's hopelessness. His gospel is one of hopelessness. It's not good news. Well, what he found in Tahiti, where he went from to find uninhibited freedom in man, he turned out to be death. He found cruelty. When he finished this painting, he tried to commit suicide, even though he was unsuccessful. He, no doubt, died a very despondent man. To answer, or to illustrate in another way, the problem of taking nature as a moral standard that Schaeffer talks about, another way to illustrate it is we can consider the Marquis de Sade. Okay, and wicked, wicked man, the Marquis de Sade. He died in 1814. The Marquis de Sade, he well understood the logical conclusion of the deification of nature. He well understood what it meant. He knew that if nature is all, then what is right. Again, what is natural is morally good. So what it is right. And nothing more can be said. The natural result of this was his sadism, his cruelty, especially to women. He wrote in La Nouvelle Justine, which was published in the late 18th century, quote, he wrote, As nature has made us, that is the men, has made us the strongest, we can do with her, the woman, whatever we please. There are no moral distinctions. There is no value system. What is right. Might makes right. You know, again, what was mentioned in prior teachings, Hitler being able to say, you know, basically the same thing from a perspective of survival of the fittest. What is right. So there is no basis for morals or for law. You know, in contrast, you have those Dutch Reformation painters that we talked about several weeks ago. They rejoiced to see the simple things in life and depict them in their paintings. They painted in a framework that had two parts. First, the creation of nature by a personal and good God, but also that there was a presence of abnormality in nature because of the fall. And that was captured in their paintings. Yes, we have a good personal God who created everything. But they also depicted the fall of nature. You know, these men who are espousing these theories and teachings of Rousseau, they are building upon a nature that has fallen. It was quite another thing to take nature as it is now and make it the measure of goodness, a fallen nature. For if nature as it exists is the standard for men to live by, cruelty becomes equal to non-cruelty. So, by the time of Rousseau and his followers, there was a tendency for the concepts, again, this idea of everything as a machine and man and his autonomous freedom. There was a tendency for the concepts to break apart and go in different directions. So the second of these four critical men who directed the shift from this older optimistic view of philosophy, an optimistic view that believed you could eventually get to to the universals. The second guy is the German philosopher Immanuel Kant. His books were very important in the thought of his day, and even today. They're influential. His books, The Critique of Pure Reason, The Critique of Practical Reason, and Critique of Judgment. He reworded the problem of that Rousseau had a bit differently. But it's still the same problem. You're going to see that in that third box in that handout, that Kant formulation. This noumenal world being over the phenomenal world. The concepts of meaning and value independent of perception by the senses, a universalism, an absolute over all things, over the phenomenal world, the world which can be weighed and measured, you know, empirically measured, okay? He thought, you know, this is the desire. How can we get from the phenomenal world to the noumenal world? He tried to keep these two worlds together. Kant tried to keep these two worlds together. In fact, much of the three books that I mentioned, he tried to solve this problem. But like Rousseau, he never really found a way to produce unity. He couldn't do it. With his work, the hope of a unified knowledge was on the threshold of splitting into two parts, neither having a relationship with the other, split into two. The humanist dilemma, which, again, arose during the period of the Renaissance, of these particulars, the individual things versus meanings and values, it had come to a part where it was about to explode. There was really a staunch understanding that there was no way, beginning from man alone, to bring the noumenal and the phenomenal worlds together. So Kant also came to the same conclusion. And again, his writings were very influential in his day. A very pessimistic view. Romanticism, again, which began with Rousseau's followers, it had started to develop and change. It developed further with a strengthened desire to believe in something. It wanted to escape. Even if to do so, it required giving up the old non-Christian philosopher's hope that people starting from themselves could, by their reason, find a unified answer to everything. They wanted to escape. But to do that, they had to realize, I have to give up on logic and reason to get there. The third of the four significant men, another German, Georg Wilhelm Hegel. His most important books were The Phenomenology of the Mind, written in 1807, The Science of Logic, finished in 1816, and The Encyclopedia of the Philosophical Sciences in 1817, and then in 1821, his book, The Philosophy of Right. Well, from Hegel's writings, it's clear that he understood the need for unity between the nominal and the phenomenal worlds. He understood that need. But his intricate system, it puts great emphasis on the centrality of the state and the flow of history. He commented in one of his books, quote, this is more of a quote that you'll read in Schaeffer's book. According to Hegel, the universe is steadily unfolding, slowly and steadily unfolding, so is man's understanding of it. There's no single proposition about reality that can truly reflect what is the case. Rather, in the heart of the truth of a given proposition, you're going to find the opposite. You're going to find the opposite to the truth that you find in any given proposition. This, where recognized, it unfolds and stands in opposition to the thesis. Yet, there is truth in both the thesis and the antithesis. And when this is perceived, these truths, there is a perceived a synthesis of the two comes together, a synthesis. And then what you have is a brand new proposition that states itself, states a truth of a newly recognized situation. But in turn, this new recognized truth is found to contain its own contradictions, its own antithesis, and the process goes on and on and on. Thus, it's the universe and man's understanding of it that unfolds. It unfolds. And you're taught that it's unfolding. What Hegel basically came up with and realized is we're taking one philosopher's teachings, and we take it, we analyze it, and we find some things that are in opposition to it. But those things that are in opposition to that truth are also true. And then when you try to bring those ideas together, you create a new idea and a new understanding. And as the next guy goes to understand and study that, well, he starts to find contradictions. And those contradictions prove true, and it goes on and on and on and on. And that is in the unfolding he talks about, that Hegel says that it's going to go on forever and ever. What a bleak outlook. In short, the universe, with its consciousness, you have man evolving, is what Hegel taught. Well, the result is that all possible particular positions are made relative. We have this idea of relativity. It's led to the idea that truth is to be sought in the synthesis rather than the antithesis. Instead of the antithesis, where some things are true and they're opposite, it is normally that we would understand truth. The opposite of it is untrue. Well, in this idea of a synthesis, truth and moral rightness will be found in the flow of history. And when you bring these things together, and it's this concept that was foundational to Marxism. Impacted also Western thought. Schaeffer, he explains that today, not only in philosophy, but in politics, government, and individual morality, our generation sees solutions in terms of synthesis and not in terms of absolutes. And when this happens, truth, as people had always thought of truth, dies. And if you ever watch a debate of particularly a Christian debater who takes a presuppositional perspective, you're going to see the atheist position, truth is dead. You know, we can look about what's happened yesterday and, you know, the centuries before it, but we have no hope that it's going to happen the same way tomorrow. Truth has died. Right, getting short on time. The last of these four great men, Soren Kierkegaard. He died in 1855, he was Danish. He wrote both devotional and philosophical books, and you can see his formulation being in that fourth square in the handout. He brought in full tide the notion that reason will always lead to pessimism. Always will lead to pessimism. That is, a person must try to find optimistic answers in regard to meaning and values on an upper level outside of reason. It's through a loop of faith, through a leap of faith, a person must try to find meaning without reason. And so you'll remember, again, that in the High Renaissance, humanistic man, starting again only from himself, he had problems concerning the meaning or value of things and of absolutes for morals. With Rousseau, it became that picture of autonomous freedom over autonomous nature. With Kant, expressed as, again, the nominal world over the phenomenal world. With Kierkegaard, it went a step further, and it became this non-reason, or what he would equate to faith or optimism, over reason and pessimism. How do you go from an area of pessimism, which is always a result of freedom, and how do you get to an answer to all things? Take that leap of faith, but the only way to do that is to abandon reason. Right, under this worldview, optimism will now always be in the area of non-reason. Why in the world would you be optimistic? It's hopeless. Well, in our day, and I've stated this multiple times, humanistic reason affirms that there is only the cosmic machine, which encompasses everything, including us. To those who hold this view, everything that people do is explained by some form of determinism. Some type of behaviorism or an idea of reductionism. Now, the terms determinism and behaviorism, they indicate that everything people think or do is determined in a machine-like way, and that any sense of freedom or choice is an illusion. You think you have freedom and choice. It's really an illusion. You're a part of a machine. A form of reductionism is man is explained by reducing him to the smallest particles which make up his body. Man is seen as being only the molecule or the energy particle, more complex but not intrinsically different. And you can see how a reductionist view could devalue human life that we see in the abortion campaigns. Well, according to these theories, that is all that man can be. Just a bag of meat. Man, beginning with his proud humanism, he tried to make himself autonomous, but rather than becoming great, he found himself ending up as only a collection of molecules and nothing more. They went from this glorious idea in the Renaissance to, you know what, we're just floating random molecules. How pathetic. How pathetic. Well, all this is related to the question of origins. What was the beginning of everything? What is the beginning of everything? You know, man has that question. Ultimately, there really are not a lot of possible answers to this question. And Schaeffer talks about him. He says, first, we could say that everything came from nothing. Everything came from nothing that is really nothing, which Schaeffer calls nothing nothing. This means that once there was no mass, no energy, no motion, and no personality out there. Schaeffer says this is theoretically a possibility, but he says he has never heard anyone hold this view. In all of his study as a philosopher, he's never really heard anyone hold to this view of coming out of a nothing-nothing. Because it seems to be unthinkable. It follows that if we do not hold, therefore, that everything has come from nothing-nothing, then something has always, therefore, existed. So, secondly, Schaeffer says, there is the possibility of a personal beginning, that everything else was made by a personality who could bring forth the universe, the space-time continuum, when it had not previously existed in any form. This is not out of nothing-nothing, for the personality would have existed previously, right? God. Now, thirdly, he says there is the possibility of an impersonal being beginning, which is largely what you hear in Big Bang. That some form of the impersonal, of the impersonal, has existed forever, even if in a form that's vastly different from what we now know. Well, in much modern thought, all begins with the impersonality of the atom or the molecule. And then everything, including life, comes forth by chance from that. This equation of the impersonal plus time plus chance producing the total configuration of the universe as we know it. All that's in it. Modern people, to believe that, they have to take it by faith. They have to take that leap of faith, abandon reason, as Kierkegaard pointed out. They have to take it on faith. And if one does it in faith, if they accept this in faith, then what true final value are they left with? You know, what meaning or value are they that are aspiring to? What do they have left? Well, for many modern thinkers, the final value is the biological continuity of the human race. What will it take for the continuity of the human race? And if this is the only final value, a person is left wondering why this even has importance. Why does that even argue as a value? And that's why you see so much in the terms of even population control. Thinking we got to have some idea of population control if human races can continue. Well, now that we've gone from the pride of man in the High Renaissance and the Enlightenment down to our present despair, we can understand better, I hope, where modern people are. Modern people have no place for a personal God, but equally they have no place for man as man. They don't even have place for love, truthfully. Logically, they have no place for love either, or for freedom, or any significance of anything. This brings a crucial problem. That beginning only from man himself, people affirm that man is only a machine. And those who hold this position, that man is only a machine, they realize that may be true, but I cannot live like I'm a machine. I won't live that way. If they could, there would have been no tension in these particulars, in their intellectual position or in their lives. There wouldn't be any tension trying to understand these things. But people who believe that they are machines, they can't live like machines. And so they got to take that leap, that blind leap of faith. against their reason, to try to give something meaning to life. Even if to do so, they got to deny reason. According to Schaeffer, this was a solution that Leonardo da Vinci and the men of the Renaissance, they would never have accepted. They would not have taken that blind leap of faith. They would rather end their lives in despondency. They wouldn't abandon reason. Those are those non-Christian older philosophers who are still optimistic. They would have thought it was intellectual suicide to abandon reason, which of course it is. And that there would not be any right to do so. And so that's really what we had. So in conclusion, trying to bring this all together, you know, put some feet on it for us. In conclusion, we must know this. How we are not immune as a church. We're not immune to humanistic teaching. We've got to remember that. We're not immune to this. These teachings of Rousseau and Darwin, even creeping into biblical theology, creating this liberalized theology, again, which is going to be discussed later. We know that the devil, he schemes to make these influences very subtle. And so we don't even see it creeping in. Just as a simple example, you know, of considering Rousseau's noble savage, his primitive innocence, that idea of a primitive innocence, it pervades Christian thought into the concept of an age of accountability. When a child is deemed to be innocent of any guilt and sin before a certain age. Now, I'm not sure when this idea of age of accountability started to show itself in church teaching, but it's an example of what happens when we synthesize the teaching of Scripture with the pagan thought of man, always trying to find an answer within this closed system devoid of a transcendent and personal God. So, as we're going through this and as we've continued, and we need to be able to understand how did we get to where we are, which is the main question of his book. And as we see these things, how can we be more aware of what we're currently dealing with so we can start to face it head on and fight back?